The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
What we're going to do now is just take a quick review of some of the essential ingredients of pietism. And I've not given you the bibliography for these, so let me tell you what they are so you can jot them down if you want. The first article on pietism that I've given you comes from the New Dictionary of Theology by Ferguson, Wright, and Packer. And it's an article there included in that volume. And it's a brief survey of the history of pietism. And the second one are some pages that are introductory and from the first article of F. Ernest Stifler's work, Stoeffler, entitled Continental Pietism and Early American Christianity. Okay? So those are two works where we can begin to just get a little bit of a handle on some of the concepts that are included in pietism. If you turn to page 516, which is the second page of the first article there, you'll notice at the end of the first full paragraph, the suggestion that the word pietism as a movement is probably something like the word Puritanism and Anabaptism. They are terms of opprobria. They are heaped upon others because of their dislike for what they see. And they take a salient feature of their practice and it becomes a label. So the suggestion here is that such was true of Pietismus, the German nickname given to a reform movement within Lutheranism by its enemies. That is, it was taken in context to denote a vain and hypocritical characteristic such as a pious hope. Okay, it may have come in response to the title of a work by Philip Jacob Spener, who lived in 1635 to 1705, and he had produced an introduction of a book of sermons by Johann Arndt, and the year for that production was 1675, and his introduction was called Pia Desideria, or Pious Wishes, and that's been translated by Theodore Tappert, whose name you should recognize as the translator of the Book of Concord that you have as a textbook. Professor Tappert, for many years, was right here at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Mount Airy, and his influence on Lutheranism and its study is profound. He's done a great deal of work. And so one thing we should be aware of is that pietistic Lutheranism actually has its historical center in America right here in Philadelphia. And the seminary in Mount Airy has deep pietistic roots. And so that's a significant aspect of the whole historical character of things. Now, if we were trying to, we'll come back to this article in a minute, but let's introduce just a few thoughts, and maybe this is not all new material, but it's worth at least relaying the foundation. And that is that when we think about pietism, we're really looking at what would be the equivalent of the spiritual life movement in America seen a few centuries earlier. If you know anything about American evangelicalism as a movement, there has been traditionally this debate between revivalism and orthodoxy. You can go back to early Presbyterian history. In early Puritanism, did everyone accept George Whitefield's preaching? Some were for him, some were against him. Are you for the revival or are you against the new lights and the old lights? Well, in a sense, that same issue between historic confessional orthodoxy versus a living personal piety and spiritual life seemed to be in tension. And that's been true in American history, and it goes back also into German Lutheranism. And it's one of the upshots, if you will, of the formalization of theology and all the battles that occurred in producing the Book of Concord and the Formula of Concord. There was a desire not for just doctrinal statements. People had gone through tremendous wars and struggles and famine and sacrifices. And they said, we need to know God. And you give us this great erudite statement of theology, but where's God in my daily life? And it seemed as though the scholastic movement of theology went this way, as peoples went this way in their hurts. There was respect for the church, and there was great scholasticism here, but it seemed as though the twain would never meet. And somehow, within the church, a lay movement springs up of leadership showing how you can know God. Someone put it this way. You can think of a scholasticism in its orthodox form as saying Christ is for us. Okay, that's the great truth of justification. Christ died for us. He is the one of who brings alien righteousness to us by faith and the great defense. Whereas the pietists were those that came along with the notion by saying, but Christ is in us and we know him. Okay, is it Christ for us or is it Christ in us? And that's an interesting tension, one of the ways we can summarize this whole movement. You know what? That's not alien from modern Presbyterianism either. I mean, if you look at the evangelical movements in America, one of the characteristics that separate the two Presbyterian bodies that most influence Westminster, in a sense, are characterized by some of those qualities. The Orthodox Presbyterian Church, even with the name Orthodoxy in its title, has a very keen concern for doctrinal conciseness and precision, and that's a wonderful quality. And yet you look at the PCA and its movement as really, as it calls itself, a continuing church, a grassroots movement, a lot of lay involvement, not theological leadership primarily bringing into being. It emphasizes a lot more, at least in its early character, personal piety and your walk with the Lord in the spiritual life. And so it's a fascinating tension, and it doesn't go away. It seems like, maybe if we put it as simply as we can, it's the old problem of how do you get the head and the heart to think together. What was it, Pascal, that said the heart has reasons the mind can know nothing of? I think that's one of the Pascalian lines. And so there's this tension or paradox within the human soul that becomes somehow part of movements. Okay, so that's part of the simple way of looking at the issue. As we go back to our outline, we want to pick up with the work of Spener. Notice the first full paragraph here in 516. Let's just read through this because I think it's very salient and summarizes the point well. It says, Spener is commonly regarded as the father of pietism. In German-speaking circles, his religious significance is judged second only to Luther. Isn't that an amazing statement? We tend to think of Spener and pietism as, at least from an American vantage point, as kind of a little blip on the screen of Lutheran history. But in the historic German Lutheran Church, Spener was seen as the second-ranking influence in Lutheranism. So we must realize how very important he is in that tradition. Coming from outside, we might not appreciate the significance of his role. And so, as the senior minister of the famous Paulskirche in Frankfurt, the young pastor expressed his concern about the corrupt state of the church. And so what you see here is this is a reform movement of sorts within the Lutheran Reformation. Okay, so a reformation is coming to reform Lutheranism. And he was reacting against the polemical orthodoxy that was sterile amid the immorality and terrible social conditions following the 30 Years' Wars in 1618 to 1648. Hoping for better times, Spener set forth his pious wishes and for the reformation of the church, and he advocated four proposals. Number one, more intensive Bible study, individually and collegia pietatis, or conventicles. He said, we need to get back into the Bible and not rely so much on confessional statements that have been defined for us by someone else. And so you might say the small group was introduced into Lutheran orthodoxy here, okay, the small group Bible study. Secondly, the exercise of the universal priesthood of believers through increased lay activity. Of course, the priesthood of the believer was a great Lutheran concept. Luther had developed that at great length. But there's now the sense that there's become a new priesthood in Lutheranism. It's the theological scholars and the clergy And they're saying we need to return the life of the church back to the laity so that it's not clerical George doing all the work, okay, to borrow a phrase from D. James Kennedy, okay, who, by the way, has very importantly involved the laity in America and around the world in evangelism, okay? Number three, the practice of Christianity in daily life and works of unselfish love. So in other words, that Christianity is to be seen very much as an ethical practice rather than just a doctrinal treatise or expression or formulation. That we must see Christianity as a lifestyle, and it's characterized by loving our neighbor by denying self. So really emphasizing the second great commandment. Okay. And fourthly, dealing with unbelievers and heretics with sincere prayers, good example, persuasive dialogue, and the spirit of love instead of compulsion. What are we seeing there? Setting aside the sword of the magistrate as the primary means of conversion and using the tools of the Spirit to win people over, which is by our prayer that we fight it spiritually, by our good work, our good example, and of course, good dialogue and persuasive in the spirit of love. Now, we begin to think about that, and we might say, now, where did these ideas come from? Okay? Well, we can find them mirrored in several sources, but these are some of the qualities of the radical tradition. They are spiritually oriented toward part of the concerns the Anabaptist movement had had, and I would say in some measure had always, to some extent, been part of some of the Puritan elements of the early Reformed tradition. Okay, so there were these ideas of very practical, we could say, experiential Christianity, that it ought to be a daily experience, or sometimes called experimental Christianity, that we daily step out to find God working in our lives. God is in us, we're moving, and it's the laity is living out the life of God every bit as much as a theologian. So a fascinating point of historical research that's available for some thought would be, what were some of the influences on Spener's thinking? Who had he been reading? Had he rediscovered these things just by his own biblical study? Were they necessitated by the times? Had he had contact with Reformed sources? Had he had contact with Anabaptist sources? Those are fascinating questions that I'm unprepared to answer, but they are significant. Right. So one of Spener's spiritual sons, another name we need to introduce then, is August Hermann Franke, 1663 to 1727. So he comes on the scene as really the next generation following after Spener. So sometimes it's called the Spener-Franke movement because these two men really carry the lead. And he attempted to implement these concerns at the University of Leipzig during 1689. And the young lecturer instigated meetings for the purpose of entering more deeply into exegetical studies. So in other words, here was the attempt now to begin to move into different regions, the whole scholarship. Usually the movement is tied in most directly with Halle. Halle became the university source for German pietism. Now, one of the German words, I don't think I've given you a copy of this. I want to make sure I get it right. One of the other authors that I've been reading, and I'll mention the work here, it's Werner Ehlert, E-L-E-R-T, and the Structure of Lutheranism. Okay, that is a work that is fairly valuable. I'd recommend, if you're looking for a good work, to look at the Structure of Lutheranism. It does its job well. But he introduces this term as one of the terms that was wrestled in Lutheran orthodoxy, but he felt becomes an excellent summary of the pietistic spirit. Word is Heiligungsstreben, okay, and translated would be something like striving for sanctification, okay, would be a good translation for the word. And so what we One of the things that we can see when we begin to look at this movement is as it attempts to invade the universities and to influence the clergy and thereby the laity and the church, a reformational movement, it was the emphasis on striving for personal holiness. And so you get words like, as I said earlier, the spiritual life in America might be a parallel connection. You can also get the word the holiness movement in America. I think whether you want to see them directly connected, they're part of the same general category. And the work by Stifler, Continental Pietism and Early American Christianity, tries to show that there is a reoccurring stream in all the denominational life of early America that reflects Pietism. So that we need to understand that Pietism has two focal points. We can define it very narrowly as that which comes from Spener and Franca, or we can define it much more broadly as this spiritual holiness, personal piety movement that penetrates all kinds of denominational life. Okay, so that we see it in those two terms. It's probably used most popularly in the second way, and so sometimes it's used as a term of derision that you're a pietist or pietism. And one of the byproducts of pietism, and we'll talk about this later, is that there tends to be a de-emphasis on doctrinal precision and more of an emphasis on a personal relationship with the Lord. So you begin to move away from the intellect and cultural development more toward a personal walk with the Lord. And it's amazing how, again, that's exactly when you look at America today. That's one of the critiques that many have come across and said, the problem with America is that after the fundamentalist controversy, they fought to have an inerrant Bible and then they went underground as evangelicals. In America, we've been largely concerned with my personal walk with Jesus. I have my Bible, it's me and the Lord. The world's getting worse. Let the world go its own way because Jesus is coming back and I'm going to be ready for him. Okay, so that the cultural expression of Christianity was lost and it went internally. So the word pietism has been kind of a negative pejorative word in this day because of American Christianity has seen the loss of the leadership of Christianity and culture. Okay, so we have to be careful when we use the word. It has a good and bad sense to it, in my opinion, and I use it both ways. Piety was a concept that Calvin very much emphasized. In fact, if you go into the Institutes and you study the word piety, you'll find that it is a frequent term in Calvin. And one of his definitions of piety was the idea that a man would rather die than sin against God. That puts it pretty seriously, doesn't it? I would rather die than sin against God. I'm so committed to doing what he wants. Okay? So that element of piety is a very deep Reformed concept, and it's there. And so now to tie into a theological expression, again, of some of our earlier thoughts, why would it be necessary in Lutheranism for there to be a reaction of pietism? I would like to propose very simply, it goes back to the paradigm of Lutheran theology by putting justification as the centerpiece, by saying that it's faith alone that brings us an alien righteousness, and that therefore the law should not be addressed to the believer. The law has no room to be addressed to the believer. Rather, the law only addresses the man as sinner, whether a converted sinner or unconverted sinner. The law is for the sinner. And that faith itself should just be working out in love, that there's this natural outgrowth of faith at work. And from a Reformed vantage point, that's saying that we need to have the balance of the covenant. We can't have justification without saying also regeneration and sanctification go together. So Calvin would say there needs to be a Heiligungsstreben, and there needs to be a striving for sanctification through the Spirit. Of course, it's all of grace, but yet there is the response in grace. So, in a sense, from a Reformed perspective, the Pietist movement within Lutheranism is a rediscovery of the doctrine of sanctification. It's not that it wasn't there, but it was difficult to integrate with putting so much of the emphasis on forgiveness, an alien righteousness, and then, if you will, almost an automatic outflow of love. Here's the idea, no, you must labor for holiness, that you must work for it, and that is not a meritorious expression, but it flows together, part of the covenant. So, now, when you come to the second article that I've given you here, it's in the same stapled packet. Let's take a look at the introduction that Stifler puts to his work. And let's just work through several paragraphs here because, again, he helps set the tone from some of the scholarship in the background. Let's just start right at the beginning. He says, to give a universally satisfactory definition of pietism would be quite impossible at this time. So, again, he's admitting the same problem that the scholars have whenever you look at these movements. They are unwieldy. What is an Anabaptist? What is a Puritan? What is a pietist? They're too big to define precisely. Okay. But he says, according to Heinrich Heppe, in his work Geschichte des Pietismus und der Mystik in der Reformierten Kirche der Niederlande, the term was first used in reference to the followers of Philip Jacob Spener at Frankfurt am Main in 1674. So you can see that he would say that the technical, precise term initially would be those that follow in Spener's tradition. It was Heppe who pointed that out. But then he goes on to say that it expanded much more broadly. And that notice the third paragraph. He says, presently, Heppe, as indicated above, found pietism in the Reformed churches of the Netherlands and W. Hadorn in the Reformed churches of Switzerland. And when Albrecht Ritschl wrote his three-volume Geschichte des Pietismus in the 1880s, there was no doubt in his mind that he was dealing here with an identifiable historical phenomenon which cuts across confessional and national boundaries. In time, others began to see the striking similarities in historical connections between the piety of certain other groups, the Puritans in England and America, the Jansenists in France, Hasidism within the Jewish tradition, and that which was practiced by acknowledged pietists. And so what's being suggested here by Ritschl is that it was almost a pervasive worldview of the time, that it went beyond denominational distinctions and confessional lines, and even was reflected in certain Jewish groups of the era that were moving, that we can see this pietistic spirit. Jansenism was really a Roman Catholic pietistic movement trying to take Augustinianism and reform the church through an Augustinian model. And it also was very pietistic. So, and here's the bottom line for Stifler, and I wanted to especially highlight this on page 9, the next paragraph. In the light of these developments, we may spell out, if not a definition, then at least a working concept of pietism as follows. So here's Stifler's attempt to say, this is what we think pietism ought to be defined as in a working concept. It is a historical movement within Protestantism which has its major roots in the Zwingli, Bucer, Calvin axis of the Reformation, which began to show its first characteristic evidences within English Puritanism and the Reformed churches of the 17th century, which influenced Lutheranism through Arndt, Spener, Francker, Bengel, and their followers, and he goes on to mention several others. And he says it went on for an indefinite period of time. But notice he goes on then to say, through the Wesleys, it helped to shape the evangelicalism of Great Britain. In America, it combined with and revitalized the older Puritan tradition to form the basic religious ethos of a host of Protestant denominations. And so what's being said here, at least from Stifler's vantage point, is that actually this could be defined as Bucerian, Calvinistic, Zwinglian pietism, piety, influencing Lutheranism. And then out of Lutheranism, as it generated itself, it began to touch the world in a number of areas, especially America. And through this pietistic movement, it touched Methodism and the older Puritanism that had become moribund to some extent. And it revitalized it. And it's in that context that George Whitefield came to America in a pietistic revival. Okay, revivalism in America should be connected to pietism. Interesting thought. So that's Stifler's model, and so there are two ways of looking at it. I'm wanting you to hear this as you think of Pietism. You can define it narrowly with the teaching of Spener and Franke, and you can see we've looked at the four proposals of Spener. Or you can look at it in a more broadly defined movement as a reawakening of personal holiness teaching and a quest to have a personal walk with God in faith and holiness that transcends the denominations and is part of a massive movement that crosses all the boundaries of many denominations of the era. Okay? And so I think the first thing to keep clear is, what do we mean when we're talking about Pietism? Maybe a good way to get a handle on it would be to speak of German Pietism, or maybe we could say Lutheran Pietism, and then Pietism in general. That might be a helpful way of getting at the distinction. Okay? So Pietism is too broad to use as a single term. It's probably better to put an adjective in front of it. Stifler argues that it probably can be traceable to the piety teaching of the early Reform movement. I think the case could be made that it may be traceable also to some influences from the Anabaptist tradition on Spener. I can't prove that, but I think it's worthy of further discussion. Okay? At any rate, what we do see is in the fourfold points of Spener is that we don't see those exactly found in Bucer and Calvin. Some of the movement away from discipline to more of a saying, forget the powerful change of discipline, let's work more toward the loving approach. That sounds much more like the radicals to me. See, so I'm wondering if there's not an influence from a double source, that there may have been a Reformed tradition of piety available and that there were other roots that were tied in. But the significant thing to see here is that this movement invaded Lutheranism very powerfully. Now, what's significant about that then for American history is that because of its influence, one of the things that Pietism became very concerned about was following the teaching of Jesus in a very personal way, on a daily basis. So that began to mean loving my neighbor. How did Jesus love? By preaching the kingdom of God, by reaching people for the gospel. So personal evangelism and ultimately missionary work became very significant in the pietistic movement. And as they heard about the condition of the colonialists in America, they're saying there are no preachers here, the churches are languishing. What was in the pietistic movement that there became a sense that we must send forth missionaries to the colonies. And so the early American expression of Christianity, which had an early strong Puritan format, was later leavened by a whole influx of pietistic missionary-minded people. And I think we see that from the Wesley Whitfield side, and we also see it from the German Lutheran side. And those influences then come into America. And Melchior Muhlenberg, if I have his name right, would be the probably great Lutheran pietist who came to America and helped organize the Mount Airy Seminary. He's one of the fathers of the area, and he had a tremendous influence in this area and the pietism. And of course, they have a statue right in this campus. That's right there. Okay. So that he would be probably the leading pietistic missionary that came to the area and had a great influence. And so you have an English and German movement coalescing that had a tremendous influence. And I like Stifler's notion, it's probably worth pursuing, that what's going on here is that you may remember that Puritanism had begun to go the direction of English deism. There was already a strong underground Unitarian movement up in Boston. There was a movement away from historic Christianity. And it was the influx of this pietistic movement from Wesley Whitfield, German sources, and otherwise, that probably saved the Puritan spirit in America and gave it a refocalized spirit. It probably would have gone totally bankrupt. And it did eventually anyway. But before it could do that, there was still survived a evangelistic, spiritually orthodox Puritanism that influenced the federal era in America for another century, and it was probably the wedding of those two movements. And the revival movement that gave us the new side, old side split in Presbyterianism and the congregational struggles. So this movement is very vital and often is not given enough attention in our understanding of American history. Okay? So those are any questions or comments on where we are thus far. I want to chime in with several other notions here. Go ahead, Larry. Now, so this movement, you see, is an interesting hybridization, if you will, between the Lutheran and Anabaptist tradition. And that's, you can see, that's
picked up an Anabaptist influence further on. And I can't speak for how much Anabaptist influence there may have been earlier.
Yeah. Well, when I look at the fourfold proposal there, they have a ring to me of being somehow looking at the Anabaptist tradition. Yeah. The number four is the one that jumps out especially strongly. Okay. Because it is indeed a move, but it could be part of their moving away from the warfare, you know, that they said we're tired of using the sword of the flesh. Let's see. And so there may have been a return. But it's a fascinating question. Very good. All right, a couple other things that we want to look at then is to begin to think about the impact of this movement in the specifics on the Christian life. If the Christian life then is becoming the focal point, so that it's not now being seen so much that I know that Jesus has died for me and I'm part of a church with its great liturgical heritage and I go about my business and worship, but now I'm trying to understand that Christ is in me, that I have a spiritual life, and I'm learning to love my... What does my life look like now? Okay? And so if there was something of a morphology of conversion in Puritanism, which mirrored, you know, there's the law work that slays you and you're under conviction and there's enlightenment and then there comes personal faith and justification... Well, what are some of the qualities that begin to show you that you are really in the pietist tradition, if you will, showing that God's work of grace is there? Well, some of the specific expressions of this can be seen. If you look at the next article that's attached in the same packet now, the first thing was the article from the New Dictionary of Theology. The second one was the introduction by Stifler. And then the first article in that volume, entitled The Influence of Pietism in Colonial American Lutheranism, this is also written by Tappert, who we mentioned earlier. So this is also an article by Tappert, and it picks up on page 16. And... the thing that we need to see here is that there was early on a struggle between the traditional Lutherans and the Pietists as they came into the American setting. And as we look at this development, we'll begin to see what the issues were over, and they're over the issues of the Christian life. What does the Christian life look like if we're really being a true one who has this piety, this desiring of living a life personally with Christ in us? Let's begin reading under that major heading, Lutheran Pietists and Their Opponents, and we'll just pick up a few thoughts there. Okay? These others were of various kinds. Some were pretenders who lacked theological education and ordination, but gave themselves out to be clergymen. Now, what that means is that in America at this time, one thing that happened, or there were those who couldn't make it into the churches in Germany, came to America and pretended to be ordained ministers, or they were dropouts and they were able to claim that they had some kind of ecclesiastical status, okay? And so they came to be known as pretenders. In fact, there still are people like that today that go around call them Reverend so-and-so, and they just are self-ordained. And they say, I have such authority. So this created the need for somehow to protect the quality of the churches. And so they developed, obviously, the ministeria or presbyteries or whatever to prove credentials. But then on page 10, as we go along, page 18, the next paragraph, It says, there is abundant evidence in the literature of the 18th century that Pietist ministers sent to America under the auspices of the Reverend Fathers in Halle were frequent objects of ridicule and attack. In other words, there was already a minister's problem. There were charlatans, false, not enough, and all, if you looked like you could fit the role, they were ready to get a minister working because there were so few of them. That the Halle University setting began to send pietistic minister missionaries to America. But when they came, they became objects of attack. Notice here, for example, some critics of Henry Melchior Muhlenberg in New Hanover, Pennsylvania said, since we have to hire a preacher for money, let's have a jolly one, for this Muhlenberg is too strict for us. Okay, so one of the things we begin to see about the pietist ministers is that they had a very strict personal ethic. Okay, whatever it was in their Christianity, it was very demanding, and it was something that they said, this is too much for us. Rumors were circulated among the people that the preachers sent from Halle are pietists, secret Zinzendorfers, heretics, false Lutherans, seducers, dangerous people. Polemical tracts written by laymen as well as clergymen belabored the Hollensians. In Freesburg, New Jersey, the United Preachers were said to be scheming and practicing hypocrisy. A minister in Virginia burned several boxes of tracts for the simple reason that the tracts had been printed in Halle. Not all of the criticisms and charges came from pretenders and similar irregular ministers, for even a man of such acknowledged probity and orthodoxy as William Christopher Birkenmeyer in the colony of New York was suspicious of all men who were infected with the plague of pietism and who engaged in pietistic loose talk about love. Still others attached to pietist ministers such labels as enthusiasts, botchers of Babel, legalists, priests of Baal, and the like. And so you see, here is the battle being developed by the false preachers, the inadequate, and also the orthodox. They were being joining together and saying, we are afraid of what Halle is producing. They look like the old-fashioned enthusiasts. Remember, Luther had a lot to say about the enthusiasts. Well, they give the same title, if you will. The Schwärmer was the German word for it, as I recall. I don't know if that's the word that underlies it here, but it may well have been. The enthusiasts. Well, it says the pietists, for their part, had criticism to make of their opponents. Some of these opponents were charged with leading dissolute lives. It seems to me that that's the charge that keeps coming back. That early on, it's fascinating that the Anabaptist condemnation of the Lutheran Reformation was that it didn't have power to produce holiness in the life of its adherents. And you can find it from various sources. Luther sometimes complained after his visitations that where's the holiness we're looking for? Melanchthon, in his visitation articles, said we must improve the holiness of our people. And you can find that in various Pilgrim Marpeck, as I recall, mentions his complaint that there's not holiness. The Schwenkfelders complained that the Lutherans are not producing holiness. The Catholics said, you've overthrown the holiness of the church. Of course, that had to be a little hypocritical in some ways because you always didn't see the holiness in Catholicism. But there was, at times, really deep piety in the Catholic tradition. So you see, Lutheranism was being charged with these sorts of issues. And so there was all of this attacking, and this, it seems to me, was the same sort of thing that I think Calvin was trying to do, to create a new piety to address the charge we must have holiness in the church. And it's being found now in the Lutheran model. And the pietist said, yes, we see too much dissoluteness in our Lutheran tradition. People who aren't living as though they've been redeemed by Christ. They say Christ is for them, but it's almost as if they can do whatever they want. Is Christ not in them too? Should he not change their lives? And so some of the things that they, as they talked about dissolute lives, listen to the things they mentioned. Pietists were offended by people who hunted, raced horses, or went swimming on Sundays. So one of the things I think we will find all through the pietist movement is a strong Sabbath-keeping strain. I think you'll find that in the Puritan pietism, if you will, in England. And Puritanism, as it was spoken of in the Reformed circles in the Netherlands, were called the precision, the precisionists. And they were very strong Sabbatarians, keeping the Sabbath with strictness. And so we find that the Lutheran pietists were also very concerned about Sabbath keeping. That would be And so you see a connection. This may be part of the Reformed influence on Lutheranism. In 1752, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg wrote a letter in English to complain, "The state and condition of some English and German neighbors here, that is in Trapp, Pennsylvania, groweth worse because De Haven continues to abuse the granted license by enticing one after another into a dissolute and wicked life, surfeiting, drunkenness, playing cards and dice, fiddling, dancing, cursing, swearing, fighting and scuffling, and such like will hardly cease on the Lord's days. He has had several Sundays in my absence, horse racing, before, during, and after divine worship." So you see, some of the qualities that they were looking for were these kind of practices to be not found in the life of the pietist, one who's walking. So that a pietist, by definition, might be described, if you take this seriously, as someone who didn't live a dissolute and wicked life. He learned to live with some kind of self-discipline that would eschew drunkenness and card playing and fiddling. Interesting. Too much popular music, you might say. And dancing. And there's obviously cursing and swearing, and they were in fights. There would not be scuffling. And certainly keeping the Lord's Day holy. Opponents of pietism were assailed. So these are the pietists attacking, if you will, the Orthodox Lutherans, apparently, who had a certain amount of freedom in such areas, for considering merriment, buffoonery, the customary dances of the world, and so-called Christian drinking parties on special occasions as permissible adiaphora. In other words, they are indifferent things. In and of themselves, neither right nor wrong. It's rather what you do with these things that makes them sinful. If you prize them more than the Lord's way, or if you do them to excess. But what they're saying is that these things ought not to be practiced. Okay? Well, you know what? Again, just to make this a relevant issue, it's very fascinating the early splits that occurred in American Presbyterianism here that influenced the early years of Westminster Seminary. One of the issues that came up very early on was the issue of drinking. Was drinking legitimate or illegitimate? And that severed very strong part of the early movement that Machen had developed. They said, we're going to be teetotalers. And they said, no, there's drinking is adiaphora. So that was a similar kind of issue that split the early years. Now, another issue that came out in those early years was premillennialism and dispensationalism. That was the issue of eschatology. You don't find that so much here at this stage, but it is fascinating that the spiritual life movement or the holiness movement has very often been associated with premillennialism historically. And I think you can go back into the Anabaptist tradition and find that emphasis on the personal holy life and also the thousand-year kingdom and the coming of our Lord to establish that. And so the doctrinal emphasis of orthodoxy versus the spiritual piety of the pietistic movement had both some doctrinal and also practical expressions. And one of the great doctrinal divides, it seems to me, came out in eschatology. And in America, at least, the spiritual movement of pietism has often emphasized not only the spiritual life, but also eschatological conferences, you know, emphasis on learning the doctrine of the last things. Whereas, on the other hand, when you look at the tradition of orthodoxy, there is tended to be an emphasis on Christian liberty, that is, the emphasis on adiaphora, that these are indifferent things, and a downplaying of eschatology, if you will, as the centerpiece of Christian thinking. And if there is teaching on eschatology, it tends to be amillennial eschatology. So it's fascinating that these movements, while they're very different in terms of expression, still are living entities even to this day. You might come along with it like, what is the difference between fundamentalism in America on the one hand, and we might say evangelicalism in America? Well, you might get into some of these same kind of issues again. They might divide. with a strong emphasis, or evangelicalism as over against, let's say, Orthodox Reformed theology. These same kind of issues keep surfacing, so they're part of our heritage, and we keep coming back to them again and again. Okay. Well, let me, with that kind of a background, showing you some of the tensions, well, let me just read a couple more remarks here, I think. It's just so you get the flavor of this article by Tappert. He goes on. Opponents of pietism, was where we left off, so let's drop down to the next line where it said Muhlenberg. Muhlenberg took his maidservant to task when she was invited to attend a frolic in the neighborhood where corn husking will be rewarded with drinks, games, and dancing. And on another occasion, he criticized his own daughter-in-law for having a tea party according to the prevailing fashion, which he thought was not according to the counsel and command of our Lord. On the other hand, alcoholic beverages were consumed instead of water, partly because available water was often unsafe for drinking, and partly because of inherited custom. It was the abuse rather than the use that was frowned upon. Beer was quite regularly brewed in the home. Beer was often served at meetings of church councils or consistories in Dutch congregations. A Swedish minister in New Jersey habitually drank a glass of wine after preaching. In Georgia, the judgment was expressed, rum is a dangerous drink, but its use cannot be forbidden altogether on that account, for experience teaches that when it is taken with moderation, it is beneficial to the health. To be sure, it might be better to substitute a light beer, but this is not easy unless one brews it oneself. So these are all pietistic expressions of thinking. So here we see some of the tension. Now, one last point that is significant from the Tappert article, and then we'll take a break here. Notice under the next heading, it says Lutheran identity in relation to others. I think it's significant that he wants to make it clear that the early Lutheran pietists saw themselves seriously as Lutherans. They did not see this as a break with Lutheranism. There were Orthodox Lutherans that wanted to push them out and say that they were radicals, but they wanted to argue that they were committed to the confessions, and that somehow they think, in a sense, they might have even had Luther on their side if he had lived to see the development of their movement. Okay, so notice the quote here. We'll put it a little bit in context. Let's just go ahead and read the whole first section of the quote, and then we'll break there. It says, the character of Lutheran pietism in a colonial America can be best illustrated by sketching a few selected aspects of its common life and activity. At the outset, it is well to underscore the fact that these people regarded themselves as Lutheran. That's a significant point I want you to see. They did not see themselves as breaking with Lutheranism, per se. They expressed this in their high regard for Martin Luther. They thought of themselves as followers of the Reformer and declared that if he were to reappear, Luther would certainly be a pietist. Now, everybody, of course, wants Luther on their side. The question is, can we demonstrate that Luther was on their side or not? Okay, so official documents uniformly committed ministers and congregations to the Lutheran confessions or standards of faith. When the Swedish churches of the Delaware River appealed to Sweden for pastors, they declared that they desired ministers attached to the Lutheran religion, which will now confess before God and the world. And when, in the response to the Archbishop of Uppsala, or Uppsala, whichever you say that, sent several ministers to the Delaware in 1696, he directed them, quote, to preach God's word, expound the prophets and other canonical books of the Old and New Testaments, as well as the Athanasian and Nicene symbols, and the true doctrines contained in the Augsburg Confession of Faith, which they were to explain clearly and purely without any admixture of superstitious or false doctrines. They were to administer the holy sacraments according to God's ordinances and instruct the children of the colonists in Luther's small catechism. And so, you see, there was this claim that we're trying to be historic Christians and confessionally Lutheran, and that our pietism flows right out of the theology of Martin Luther. That's how they wanted to see it. Okay? Well, we're going to come back and look at some of Luther's thought about some of these things and see if that claim is legitimate. So let's take about a 5 or 7 minute break or thereabouts, and we'll come back.